what we've identified is that the average age of a farmer here in Arizona is about 61 years of age, and they are rapidly retiring or aging out, and we do not have a new workforce coming in to replace them. And this is something that keeps me up at night, because if we don't protect that local food shed and make sure that it remains viable, then I worry about what our prospects are for the future.
I mean, there's also a projected 40% increase in folks experiencing homelessness. And we've already seen this even before the pandemic, we were having our numbers rise. And that's just because incomes are not keeping up with rent. Rent is skyrocketing. And our state is very much a reactive instead of a preventive state. And so we're not funding the support systems to help people have access to food, have access to proper health care and affordable housing.
The horrible outcomes from the pandemic, coupled with all of the civil unrest that we've seen in recent months, have created what I think a majority of people now see as something that we need to react to. We have to react to this now. It might not be the perfect timing that us public health minded folks might wish for. It is an opportunity for us to say, these are the solutions that are here now and have always been here. So let's take advantage of them.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Vitalist Spark podcast. I'm your host, John Ford. And well, on behalf of all of us here at the Spark, I've got a secret confession to make. In the 2 years since this podcast originally launched, we've talked consistently about the need for policy change, but we've never produced an episode focused on an Arizona legislative session. Embarrassing, I know. Can't be true, right? Well, it is. But all that changes today. In this, our 64th episode, we've got some policy champs on the line to talk about what's going on related to healthcare, housing, and food during this 2021 legislative session. The big question, of course, is how does the pandemic shape what's going on down there? Well, we're going to get to that in just a moment. But before we do, let's be glad that this is true. COVID-related measures do continue to improve in Arizona. That said, the U.S. just hit a truly devastating milestone of 500,000 deaths from COVID. That means that 4% of the world's population has endured 20% of this pandemic's fatalities. So things may be better than they were in January, but they're still worse than they should be. In order to slow the spread and really get to a safer, better place, you've got to stay home as much as you can, wash up and mask up when you can't, and help shut COVID down. It really truly is that simple. When we don't do these things, cases rise and more people die. When we do, cases fall and we save lives. Do your part, slow the spread, be COVID smart. There's a lot to learn about in this episode, so let's get right to it. It's time to talk about what's going on with food systems, housing, and healthcare during this year's state legislative session as of February 22nd, 2021. Today, we are digging into the legislative session. To do that, we brought together some amazing guests, starting with Joan Servis from the Arizona Housing Coalition. Joan, how are you doing today?
Hi, thanks for having me.
And from Pinnacle Prevention, the woman who knows everything about food, Adrian Udarby. Adrian, how are you?
I'm doing great. Great to be with you guys.
Last but not least, my colleague, but also an amazing state health policy director, Mr. Marcus Johnson from Vitalist Health Foundation. Marcus, how are you?
I am here. I am not a cat.
We'll figure out what that means later. So all three of you are no strangers to the legislature. Joan, I'm going to start with you and ask you, what is the climate right now, both in terms of direction and also how the legislature is responding or not to the pandemic?
Excellent question. I'll give you my perspective, and that is that the legislature is treading in unknown waters. I think they are trying to figure out the most appropriate state response to the pandemic, but there's obviously politics involved and opinions. And so that definitely becomes extra noise to an already convoluted situation. But I do think that legislators, they were tasked with defining a small agenda to respond to COVID-19. I think it's gotten a little broader as the time has gone on, but I do believe they have the intention of really addressing these time-sensitive, crucial issues to support Arizonans struggling with the pandemic.
Adrian, you're nodding your head. Is that about your sense of the situation as well?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think on the fly, they were making decisions of how to engage community in a way virtually and trying to adopt Zoom and all of these different things so folks could be able to speak in committee. Our system wasn't set up to be able to do. So to be able to do that very quickly has been both a blessing and a curse. I do think it's been valuable as a tool, just in that folks from different parts of the state, especially those that are hundreds of miles away from the Capitol, have been able to engage now in new ways that they wouldn't have been able to before, just by virtue of the travel barriers and different things like that. So I do hope to see some of those things continue. It's nice to see folks engage that haven't been able to, but there's also technology hurdles that come along with that.
Marcus, your take on that, but also on the request to speak system itself and some of the vagaries of how it works and how that might preclude people from actually participating.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll start off with saying I completely agree. At the beginning of the legislative session and coming into it, a lot of people were ready and preparing for complete chaos at the legislature. We knew that the margins in both the House and the Senate were really, really thin, with Republicans holding on to power still, but again, in thin margins. And so people weren't really sure what to expect because of the political makeup and because of the pandemic. What we've seen at the legislature this year is a relatively normal session in terms of being able to schedule committee hearings and hearing bills. So that's been a positive without much spread of the virus, especially throughout the legislature, which has been a big win. In terms of the request to speak system, like Adrian had mentioned, it wasn't designed necessarily to accommodate the scale that it is right now. It's been sometimes agonizing, sometimes fun, yet always understandable to see community members, legislators, anybody trying to figure out how to use Zoom at a state legislative session, which has been interesting. But again, one of the drawbacks to the RTS request to speak is that if you have never used it before and you want to weigh in on legislation, you have to first go down to the legislature to sign up for it at these kiosks that are in the chamber buildings. It's a really simple process to do to register, but it means you have to be in physical proximity of the state legislature. So that's still one of the drawbacks. But fortunately, I know that our partners on the podcast today, there are ways to get around that so long as you find the right organizations or people who can actually go down to the legislature and sign up for you.
Indeed, Joan. Talk about your workaround for that one.
Sure. So we've got to embrace technology. And so at our website, if you go to azhousingcoalition.org, we outlined our 2021 state legislative priorities. And then we have an instant advocacy portal. You enter in your contact information, your home address, so it can identify who is your state legislators, and it can send a customized message. Obviously, we want it to be focused on some of our legislative priorities, but it can actually be customized to whatever issue is most relevant to that individual. That's a workaround. I do know that there's advocacy organizations that are sending runners to the state legislature to create those accounts. I think it's Civic Engagement Beyond Borders. I think it is. It's a kind of offshoot of the Save Our Schools Arizona that is, again, sending runners. And we also will send runners to, just because we want to make sure everyone has that open communication and connection with our state lawmakers.
Adrian, how about you?
Yeah, if you go to azfsn.org, so that's the Arizona Food System Network webpage, and you can go to the advocacy page on that website, and we have a way that folks can click a button there to create a request to speak account, and we have members of our coalition team that will go down if somebody needs their account activated for the first time, and we'll do it for them.
Okay, Marcus, now that we have some sense of what the legislature looks like and how people can engage, let's run it down. There's a very long list of possible things to talk about as it relates to public health, healthcare, food, housing, and that's really what we want to get into today. So if you wouldn't mind, sir, go for the overview.
So I'll do my best. The way that I kind of characterize some of the legislation that Vitalist is tracking and signing in support or opposition of right now, I think of it as the good, the up in the air, and missed opportunities. So there's actually a lot of great bills and legislation that's passing through the legislature right now, which I'm really happy to say. And I'll let Adrian and Joan speak to their specific issue areas and the legislation that they've been doing a great job with. A couple of other areas that is really encouraging is syringe access programs or needle exchange programs, or the legislature that now being coined overdose disease prevention programs. So what used to be a really controversial item at the legislature has now been largely recognized as evidence-based public health practice. It used to have a stigma around it that this was really increasing the likelihood that people would be using needles and using illicit drugs. But what the research has showed us is that when you offer clean needle programs to individuals who are using drugs, it actually cuts down on the spread of communicable diseases like HIV and hepatitis C. And what I think is most interesting is that it actually opens the door to relationships with these individuals and populations, and it builds trust to be able to get them into other services that can benefit their livelihoods in general. So that's moving through the state legislature, which is great. That's Senate Bill 1250-1250. There's also some great legislation for mental health. One of the bills that we're tracking is a bill that would require any sort of health education courses offered in K through 12 school. They would also have to have some sort of training around mental health. So it's not just health education in typical PE, physical activity type fashion, but also thinking about mental health, which is great. And I think in large part due to some of the leadership of the legislature and the governor's office, some of the bills that come back time and time again that would expand the ability for individuals to opt out of vaccinations, those have been held back. Right now in Arizona, we're constantly teetering on the cusp of herd immunity, especially for transmissible diseases like the flu. And we don't want to do anything that would jeopardize that. So when bills do come to the legislature that would potentially threaten our ability to achieve herd immunity, we're fortunate still to have leadership in the state that have pushed back against those. So those are some of the good things that have happened thus far.
Adrian, when the pandemic started, the very first thing that collapsed was food. Literally empty shelves, literally small towns with nothing to eat.
Yeah, what COVID really brought out, it's brought out a lot of the disparities that have existed across all of our respective systems, but it really heightened those disparities that we're seeing within the food system. And at the onset of COVID, when we are dependent on this centralized distribution food system type beast, how that trickles down is that our local food system and those supply chain disruptions are the first that get impacted by that. And that's what we saw. So then there became a huge rush and a demand to move towards those local food system sources, our local farmers, our farmers markets, all of those different aspects that weren't as impacted by those supply chain disruptions. Not to say that they weren't, but they weren't as highly impacted. At the onset of COVID, during the last legislative session in 2020, we were pushing a bill that would appropriate permanent funding for the Double Up Food Bucks program, which basically matches dollar for dollar. It's a nutrition incentive program. For every dollar a SNAP recipient spends with their EBT benefits at a participating site, we match it with an additional dollar for Arizona grown fruits and vegetables. COVID cut that 2020 sessions short, and then we saw a huge demand and increase in SNAP utilization and spending, and quickly we're running out of funding for the program. So because we weren't able to get that permanent funding appropriation passed, we went to the governor's office, and the governor quickly saw the value and the benefit of this as both a feeding and immediate food response solution, but also an economic solution because it supports local Arizona farmers. And they provided a $500,000 COVID relief appropriation to carry us through. We thought that would get us through the entire year. We quickly expended that by September. And so they were gracious enough at the governor's office to appropriate an additional $500,000 in COVID relief funding. That really set the stage and made the case for an ask this legislative session for $1 million in annual recurring appropriations to keep this program going. And this isn't just a policy initiative that's a response to COVID, albeit it is a response to feeding people, keeping dollars circulating in the local economy, supporting local farmers, but it's just good food policy. It's a good food policy solution moving forward and something that we want to see because in the end, good ROI on saving healthcare dollars as well, too, when we're making sure folks have access to good, healthy foods.
Joan, speaking of good policy, for you and the work of housing in this state, I don't even know where you start because we were already in crisis before the pandemic. Now the pandemic has created this weird K-shaped economy. We've got ridiculously high rising rents and housing costs, and we still lack a whole lot of fundamental tools to fight that crisis. Talk about where your thoughts are now and what bills you have moving through the legislature.
Yeah, we were in that affordable housing crisis before the pandemic even started. And even our federal government has paid attention to that. And we're seeing up even our healthcare partners like at the CDC place an eviction moratorium, recognizing that people can't be displaced from their housing and really that value of housing. And so we have a couple of policy levers that we think that our lawmakers can enact to address the housing shortage that we have and to help folks who are not only at risk of losing their housing, but also the folks that are currently living on the streets. And we want to make sure that they don't acquire or transmit the COVID-19. So there's a few different policy options that we are exploring. And frankly, to be fair, both of them we've been exploring since before the pandemic, but we think that they're the right policy choices. The first is something that we've been beating this drum since 2010, and that is to restore the State Housing Trust Fund, which is a fund that is administered by the Arizona Department of Housing, was actually created in the early 90s and is funded in large part to unclaimed property proceed revenues that gets deposited into this housing trust fund. And it goes to meet the housing needs of all Arizonans. But during the last economic downturn, that housing trust fund was capped at $2.5 million, which is not a lot of money to address the state's unique housing challenges. So we've been working to restore that fund. We were successful in 2019 in getting a one-time appropriation of $15 million. And that $15 million went to help nearly 300 people, bring them into housing before the pandemic. So 300 more households, their lives changed because of that one-time appropriation. But that's not an ongoing appropriation. So we are working with our state lawmakers to restore the Housing Trust Fund, which would uncap it from the $2.5 million annual state general fund appropriation and would restore it back to its original appropriation of 55% of unclaimed property proceeds, which by budget estimates would have an impact of about almost $10 million to the state general fund. But that's a more appropriate response to addressing unique housing challenges our state faces. We are working with several different lawmakers. There's been about three or four different pieces of legislation introduced at the state legislature. One, House Bill 2049, introduced by Representative Chavez, would appropriate $25 million to the Housing Trust Fund. Senate Bill 1723, introduced by Senator Alston, would go back to that original formula. Ultimately, we just want more of an appropriation to the Housing Trust Fund. So at the end of the day, we're going to be supportive of either of those measures. The other policy intervention that we think is an appropriate response is to adopt a state affordable housing tax credit, which mirrors the federal low-income housing tax credit, which is responsible for a lot of the affordable housing production and preservation that we see across the nation. This state tax credit would serve as an incentive to get more affordable housing developers in the space of creating affordable housing, recognizing that there's a lot of regulations and a lot of additional fees and fines associated with affordable housing production. So if you have additional tools to the affordable housing toolbox, you can create more units and you can bring the more desperately needed units online, which I think, you know, this pandemic has really shown that renters, they obviously want to afford their rental home, but they may even want to look at first-time home ownership. But the gap is widening so much because there's not enough housing stock. We need diverse housing stock, but most importantly, we need that affordable housing stock. So we need to bring more units online. That state affordable housing tax credit would serve as that tool. And we would be joining upwards of 20 other states have adopted a similar measure. So those are our two policy choices. We're hopeful that our state lawmakers would agree with us.
Joan, it's projected by the Arizona Bar Foundation that when the CDC determines that they're going to lift the eviction moratorium, it's possible that upwards of 20 plus thousand people will be out of their homes in April. And yet we cannot get an increase to the Housing Trust Fund or get a state low-income housing tax credit bill passed.
Well, we're hoping that our lawmakers are paying attention to that sad fact. I mean, there's also a projected 40% increase in folks experiencing homelessness. And we've already seen this even before the pandemic, we were having our numbers rise. And that's just because incomes are not keeping up with rent. Rent is skyrocketing. And our state is very much a reactive instead of a preventive state. And so we're not funding the support systems to help people have access to food, have access to proper health care and affordable housing.
Marcus, speaking of reactive, last year, after many, many years of struggle related to getting telehealth services, the proper reimbursement they need for everybody to be productive with telehealth, during the pandemic, some emergency provision was made for telehealth reimbursement. Talk about what's happening in the state legislature right now related to that.
Certainly. Before I jump to telehealth, I do want to just piggyback on what Joan was talking about in terms of reactivity. I think that is true for the state of Arizona. I think that's true for the United States in general. I think that's true for the majority of humans on this planet, is that we are reactive by nature. Those of us who are public health minded, maybe we're a little bit more focused on prevention, but I think that that's a constant struggle. And so this year is unique in that the horrible outcomes from the pandemic, coupled with all of the civil unrest that we've seen in recent months, have created what I think a majority of people now see as something that we need to react to. We have to react to this now. It might not be the perfect timing that us public health-minded folks might wish for. It is an opportunity for us to say, these are the solutions that are here now and have always been here. So let's take advantage of them. So I say all that to just emphasize that we do have a unique opportunity right now to bring together coalitions of individuals, not everybody, but hopefully we can bring together enough people, enough decision makers to get some of these policy provisions passed at this legislature. And one of those is telehealth and telemedicine. We have seen that obviously we cannot be in person. We cannot be in person for this podcast. We cannot be in person for the majority of our work hours, for our social lives. So we rely on these digital tools. And the same goes in the healthcare setting too. There has been a significant uptick in the utilization, the use of telehealth and telemedicine services. And so a couple of years ago, the legislature passed what's known as coverage parity. Coverage parity basically says, if you are a health insurance company, you have to cover services that are provided in person. You also have to cover those services through telehealth and telemedicine means. But that coverage parity legislation didn't say anything about payment, didn't say you have to pay 20% of in-person rate or 50% of in-person rate or 100%. It was completely silent on that. What's now moving through the state legislature is what's known as payment parity. It is a proposal that says that if you are offering telehealth medical services as an insurance company, you have to reimburse those services at the exact same level as you would if those services were provided in person. So in-person services and telehealth services would be reimbursed at the same rate. The majority of stakeholders are in agreement that that is a good idea. There's still some pushback from the insurance industry, but we recognize that if telehealth is to continue to be offered, especially for the benefit of underserved populations or particularly rural populations who don't have the degree of providers that we do in more urban areas of the state, then we're gonna miss a big opportunity if we're not able to pass this. So it is moving through the legislature, fortunately. It's one of the bills that I kind of have in the up in the air category because there's a lot of nuances around it that some people like and some people don't like, and there's still some friction there. But we are hopeful that something resembling payment parity will move forward for telehealth this session.
So you got your categories, I got mine. My categories are, what are the things we should have been doing all along that are even more important now? In that regard, Marcus, talk about kids care and the potential expansion of health insurance for children in Arizona.
Unfortunately, Arizona has one of the highest rates of uninsured children in the entire United States. And the disparities are even more stark when you look at Native American uninsured children in Arizona. There are things that other states have done, like expand the income criteria for kids to be eligible for kids care. And again, kids care is basically an arm of Access or an arm of Medicaid that is for children whose families make too much money for traditional Medicaid, but don't really make enough to be able to qualify for commercial insurance. And so there was a push this year to introduce legislation that would expand income eligibility for kids care. Unfortunately, it didn't go anywhere. I think partners weren't really expecting it to go anywhere this year, but they did want to reintroduce that idea and to shine a light on the fact that there's a lot more that we as a state can do in order to make sure that our kids have health insurance coverage in the state.
Now, by contrast, Adrian, in this same category of things that should have been happening all along, you've actually had a little more luck, if you will, and that relates to local food production. Talk about the legislation you have rolling through on that front.
Yeah, so one of our other bills within the food system lens is the Agriculture Apprenticeship Bill. And this is being led by the AHO Center for Sustainable Development through the Ag Workforce Coalition. So a coalition of many, many young, amazing farmers from all across the state. And basically what we've identified is that the average age of a farmer here in Arizona is about 61 years of age, and they are rapidly retiring or aging out, and we do not have a new workforce coming in to replace them. And this is something that keeps me up at night, because if we don't protect that local food shed and make sure that it remains viable, then I worry about what our prospects are for the future. So this bill aims to offer a 2-year pilot program, which will fund an agriculture apprenticeship program. We have a lot of amazing apprenticeship programs here in Arizona, but we've never had one specific to agriculture. So this is really serving a unique need. And what we've seen is that there may be young kids that are coming out of high school, maybe they go to college, maybe they don't, but they have a strong interest in getting into agriculture. But there's no way to learn how to do that unless you have hands in the dirt. So this gives them the hands in the dirt experience by connecting them with a farmer who can mentor them and tell them all the ins and outs of becoming a farmer and having a farm business. It's also for folks that maybe are leaving another job and decided that they want to pursue agriculture as well too. So it will pay for that individual's time. So they'll actually get paid to be an apprentice and learn while they're going. The farmer who is mentoring them can also get paid as well too. It certainly doesn't cover all the costs, but it certainly removes some of those barriers where just the sheer fact that somebody needs to get paid to keep a roof over their head while they're doing this work so that they see it as a viable future is really important.
You had asked about what are some of the things that we should do now that we should have always been doing? One of those things is adequately funding our state's 211 program. This is the statewide information referral line that has been operating on a shoestring budget for many, many years.
Fumes,
yeah. They have thousands and thousands of calls that are coming in now based on the pandemic, and are still having to go back to the legislature every single year to fight for adequate funding so that the Arizonans who call into the phone line don't have to talk to an automated bot, that they can talk to a real person who can help them to navigate through the services they need, regardless whether it's food or housing or healthcare or you name the service. This often gets tied up in some political hot button issues down at the legislature, but we're hopeful that there are new avenues this year in order to get 211 the funding that they need, that avenues that don't necessarily require a legislative bill. By the end of this, we are hopeful that we will still have additional funding going to our 211 system.
Joan, we're like 60 episodes into this podcast, and you're the first guest to use charades, hand signals to let us know that you'd like to say something. I saw you touching your nose. What would you like to say about 211?
No, I was just saying that Marcus is spot on. He's right on the money. We need to really invest in our 211 system. I've been in several meetings with 211 operators and what they've shared, and it's so amazing, their support of folks in crisis. But what they've shared is it's not the average person that's calling in during this pandemic. It's the person that's never encountered any kind of help system. They have never called and asked for a food box. They have never called and asked for utility assistance. And all of a sudden now they have an eviction notice and they don't know what to do, who to turn to. I mean, let's be honest, when you're going through an eviction or experiencing unemployment because of COVID-19, it's kind of a shame-filled process. So you don't want to ask for help. Thankfully, we do have an operating 211 system that you actually get to talk to somebody and they can connect you and navigate you to the appropriate resource for you. That wasn't always the case. And we need to make sure that people are getting that support that they need. So I just really fully believe that we do need that 211 support system to navigate folks through the process. Since I'm talking about evictions, I'll just share that this whole eviction conversation, that was also an opportunity that's ripe for reform before the pandemic. There's really just not a lot of easy answers because we need support for our landlords and our renters. Our landlords are the necessary supply in the supply and demand conversation. We also need renters understanding their obligation. So we need to have strong communication between both parties and strong education to figure out what programs exist for both landlords to be kept whole and renters to remain stably housed. And hopefully it's that two-in-one system that connects both parties. But again, we just need more resources to help people remain stably housed.
It's just so incredibly important. So the majority of phone calls that we get into our office are folks that have, by the time they reach us, a live person, they've navigated about 10 different automated systems. They may have gotten cut off. They may have been placed on hold for hours. And so when they reached us, they are exhausted and they are frustrated. So to be able to refer them to a well-funded, well-sourced 211 all-inclusive place to get their questions answered is quite literally a lifesaver for most of the folks that we are working with and talking with on a daily basis. So I just can't sing the praises and the importance of that bill enough. So there's one more bill that is really important in the food world, and that is House Bill 2689. And this bill will basically allow for folks who may have been formerly experiencing incarceration and were convicted of a felony to still be able to access food when they are back out in the real world, which is so critical because food is a fundamental human right. And they've done their time and they need to go out and be able to feed themselves. So I don't know how likely it is that this is going to move all the way that it needs to, but at least it's out there and it's on people's radar. So it's really important. And we're really excited to see our friends at Arizona Food Bank Network really being great champions behind that effort.
Adrian, Joan, we would be remiss if we did not talk about the awesome job that you all have done down at the legislature year in and year out, whether it's this year, last year, the year before, it doesn't matter. You all have been champions. You've been framing the issues. You've been garnering community champions to work with you. Tell us about your recipe for success. Start with Adrian.
I think our recipe for success is that we're data nerds and we can go in with all the data in the world, but really knowing that values is what changes hearts and minds. And so just trying to humanize the person that's sitting across from us, that legislator that's sitting across from us, regardless if they are majority party, minority party, blue, red, whatever that might be, what are their values? And really speaking to those values and knowing that food is a connector for all. Everybody has a story behind food. So when we can go in and we can tell them what the bill is and the data says this and this is why, when we give them a story, then they start to listen. And then they share their stories in return. It might be stories of, well, my grandfather had a farm, or my auntie used to teach me how to garden, and I really wish I had this, or my favorite meal is this. And so I think the recipe for success for us is truly recognizing that food is connection and that we speak to folks' values and we see them as humans. And everybody can get behind that because food is bipartisan.
Joan, I heard relationships, people, and stories. What's your experience? What's in your recipe?
Well, I do think it is important, and our sector really works to define the need and scope. But I think to Adrian's point, I think good policy is a mix of storytelling and data to come up with the correct source and the correct answer. I will say our community of affordable housing and ending homelessness advocates, I would appreciate them. Our members, they're resilient and nimble folks that are working on the fly and working really hard to help folks in need. And so I give them all the kudos. And we struggle as an advocacy organization, making sure that we frame it around the person that's actually impacted, the person that's either experiencing homelessness or some kind of housing insecurity. But we don't have that direct connection. It's our members that are in the day-to-day, the housing case managers, the navigators, the support services. They do an amazing job of telling that story and being that testimony to the person who's struggling. But again, we really do need to focus on what's the best answer for folks who are struggling and how can we best help them with whatever resource. And we need to really make sure that we're listening to them. So it's an appreciation and desire all at the same time.
Here comes the Whopper question. We're going to start with Marcus. It's a three-part question.
A three-part Whopper question? Like a triple Whopper?
It's a triple Whopper. Burger King, eat your heart out. All right. When it comes to blank, what did the earliest part of the pandemic show us? What does it look like a year into COVID? And how can we move forward productively with that knowledge?
When it comes to healthcare, when it comes to access to care, what did COVID teach us? What have we learned? COVID has taught us that healthcare does not necessarily need to be provided in person. It doesn't require the physical contact of a provider and a patient or a person. A year into the pandemic, I think we have reaffirmed that. I would be hard-pressed to think that any of us on this podcast or anybody listening doesn't have firsthand experience or know somebody who in recent history has met virtually with a healthcare provider and said, you know what? That was kind of cool. Didn't have to drive to see my provider. I still got the information I needed. I feel like I learned something and I'm better off for it. Years from now, I think we'll look back on this period with surprise that we ever had a healthcare system that was so focused on physical touch, in-person services. And I think this really can be a watershed moment for the industry.
Yeah, but no waiting room magazine, no half an hour in the waiting room.
Coloring books, those fun toys where you move the colorful piece all around the diorama.
Joan, it's up to you. The whopper question. When it comes to housing, what did the earliest part of the pandemic show us? What about a year later? And how do we move forward productively?
So I had some time to think about it, Marcus, but still, it is a whopper. I think the earliest part of the pandemic showed us that, you know, really the value of a home and how unaffordable it is for far too many. I think a year into it, we've seen how flexible our home is for many. It's a place for schooling and for work and a place to spend the night. But for folks who can't afford it, it's a struggle and it's a big stress. It's a big emotional, mental stress for them. In terms of how do we move forward, I think we need to see all of the sectors coming together. We have a new administration who's putting a lot of emphasis on housing and addressing housing challenges that the nation feels. In Arizona, we see a lot of our business leaders coming to the table and investing with new innovations and new innovative housing models. And the philanthropic community and our faith-based community and nonprofit support system, we're all coming to the table and really valuing the importance of home. I know that our lawmakers agree with us. We just need them to come to the table as well and invest.
Adrian, the whopper is yours.
So early in within the food system, I think COVID really highlighted that food is essential and folks that were most impacted were our food system and food service workers, whether those were those that are working in processing or grocery environments or restaurant environments as well too. So those that feed us are the ones that now need to be fed. And so we also now, a year in, know that when you invest in increasing SNAP benefits for folks, making it easier for folks to access nutrition assistance programs, that does move the mark in reducing food insecurity. So those are things that we want to see remain permanent. Moving forward, I think we need to tackle a little bit better here in Arizona with respect to food policy, the intersection between food and land. So we're pushing this great bill that's going to get more farmers out there, but if they don't have any land to farm on, I feel very worried about that. So if we want to protect the resiliency of our local food system, we have to talk about land and development and how those two things can coincide together. And of course, also with that goes water as well too. So I look forward to those future conversations as well. And I'm hoping by the end of this legislative session that we'll see somebody as a cat filter somewhere within the Arizona legislature. I haven't seen it yet, but that's what I'm personally looking forward to.
Oh, that'd be great.
Thank you, Marcus. Thank you, Joan. And thank you, Adrian. Not just for being on this podcast, mind you, but for your tireless dedication to the work of combining stories, data, and relationships into the recipe that produces crucial community-driven health legislation for our state. Meaningful impact comes through policy, systems, and environmental change that the three of you work day in and day out to help make the law of this land. Such changes are the holy grail of public health, and the efforts of so many Arizona health advocates and nonprofits is instrumental in helping to inform legislative action. The Vitalist Spark will be back next week. In the meantime, our back catalog of episodes awaits your ears. There is a lot to listen to, including guests from across the state and national experts too. Visit us on the web at vitalisthealth.org/podcast. Check out all of our current and past episodes on Spotify, or simply reach into that podcast app you're using right now and select another show to find out what's going on related to health and well-being in Arizona. That's it for now. The insights, reflections, and takeaways from this dialogue belong at the family dinner table, as much as they do in business settings, in city and town halls, and in the domains of healthcare and public health. So please, share this independent episode far and wide. Subscribe to the Vitalist Spark podcast to get notified as soon as new episodes are released. Or listen to the Vitalist Spark just like you listen to your favorite music on Spotify. Give us your feedback wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can also give us your input the old-fashioned way. Your corrections, complaints, and compliments are all welcomed by emailing us at feedback@vitalisthealth.org. Finally, remember this. With great responsibility comes great power. We'll see you back on the road to well-being soon.